Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Senator Ed Markey joins us to talk about the hearings on the Merrimack Valley gas explosions.
Gas distribution companies need to put safety above speed. If Columbia Gas and NiSource refuse to do that, then they should not be operating in our state or any other state.
Also today, financing new recreational marijuana businesses in Massachusetts.
To really get to a point where banks are going to feel extremely comfortable doing this, you have to have some change at the federal level.
Plus, as sea levels rise, one writer says we might need to plan for a Boston without Newbury Street or Fenway Park.
We need to think about innovative infrastructure solutions, but ultimately they're going to buy us time. And the lowest lying places, those are places that I think we are going to have to consider giving up.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the hearings will continue into September's Merrimack Valley gas explosions. A state hearing is scheduled next week. Yesterday, those directly affected got a chance to air their concerns during a federal hearing in Lawrence. Among those who spoke was Luciani Rondon, sister of Lionel Rondon, the 18-year-old man killed in the explosions.
We will not have the joy of seeing the wonderful man we know he would have become. I stand in front of you in his honor. I will never have my brother back. But we hope there will be justice for him in the community.
Senator Ed Markey led yesterday's special federal hearing in Lawrence, and he joins us on the phone. Hi there, Senator Markey. Hello, Senator, are you with us?
No, I'm here. Yeah, great. Good afternoon.
Great
to be with you.
Yeah, nice to be with you, too. You were among those at the hearing yesterday calling on the Columbia Gas executives to step down because of the way these explosions have been handled. Why?
Well, they had plenty of warning. They decided at each step to choose safety over savings. To make easy decisions over the right decisions. And ultimately, it's pretty clear that there were plenty of opportunities for this company to have put in place the safeguards which could have avoided this catastrophic event.
Well, what we know so far from this event, Senator, and fill in the blanks here if I'm misrepresenting this, but investigators have put much of the blame on an engineer. They say that a construction crew replacing a gas pipeline in South Lawrence mistakenly left a pressure sensor on an abandoned pipe and then didn't put a new sensor on the new pipe. So therefore, when one of them was registering low pressure, more gas was coming into the system and it overburdened it. So I'm just wondering, is that what happened here? And if that's the case, from what we've learned from the National Transportation Safety Board investigation, I wonder what role regulators have here in terms of making sure that the sensors are on the proper pipes and that they're functioning properly. Isn't that also a regulatory issue?
Yes, it's both. Both the company had responsibility and the regulators had responsibility. There was a climate that is ultimately created from the federal level by the Pipeline Safety Agency, which was there yesterday to testify, which allows for a lowest common denominator set of safety procedures to be put in place. There is very little oversight, and in that atmosphere, Columbia Gas allowed an underqualified, uninformed engineer to unilaterally approve the pipeline construction work plans that caused the entire disaster. So that showed a total breakdown of safety culture and management, and we still don't have a clear answer of how the failure to consult experienced technicians could have been allowed to happen and whether it happened on other jobs across the Commonwealth. But ultimately, Columbia Gas never expected that a disaster of this magnitude could happen, and as a result, they were not prepared to prevent it or to respond to it. Yes, one engineer, one unqualified engineer, did play a terrible role, but this goes beyond one individual. This is a culture which was opposed to really strong safety protections being put in place.
And how did you see that? How did you see that there was a culture at Columbia Gas that was opposed to taking stronger safety steps?
They had a policy at the company 4 years ago, for example, that would have had somebody in place to be able to monitor what was going on. But they decided 4 years ago to just discontinue that extra level of safety precaution that could have potentially prevented this accident. So we could see that there was a shortchanging, which did take place over time, and it manifested itself in multiple ways.
Do we know anything further about when service might be restored? The initial deadline, I believe, was November 19th. Then that was pushed back to December 16th. Is that a realistic time frame as to when these families might get service restored? Is that your understanding?
That's what they're saying. But again, this is almost a take-home exam for the company. So they gave themselves a November deadline, and then they missed it. Now they're giving themselves a December deadline. There's no guarantee that they're going to meet it. Part of the reason why I wanted to have a hearing up there was to make sure that they're going to be watched very closely over the next several weeks to ensure that they do not shortchange or short-circuit the telescoping of the time frame, which it's going to take to make sure that everyone, every business, every residential home has the service which they need.
Let's make sure that we get you to talk about a few other things. I want to ask you a bit about the situation involving a Massachusetts woman, Sandra Hahn, and her two adult children. They are apparently not allowed to leave China. Now, you've tweeted that your office is aware of this situation. Apparently, police in China say that they are trying to get to the father of the two adult children, and they would like the father to return to China to face criminal charges. Now, the mother and these two adult children are American citizens. Have you been able to speak with them?
Well, we're as you said, we're aware of the issue, and that's why I tweeted out. We are working actually with federal agencies, and I hope we will safely help them to return home. That's my goal, is to wade in with the feds to make sure that we do everything we can to help the family.
So what does that mean? What can you say? What exactly is happening to try to get them back from China?
Well, I have a person who is an expert on these types of issues on my staff, and she is working on it right now, and we're trying to keep open lines of communication so that everyone knows of our interest and how important it is for this to be resolved positively for the family.
Mm-hmm. So you haven't spoken with Sandra Hahn, the woman involved here, directly?
I have not spoken personally.
Or anyone from your office?
But my staff is working, to accomplish the goal, yes.
Now, China says that what is happening here is that this is an exit ban, which it says that it sometimes uses to try to coerce people into giving the country information, especially when there are criminal cases involved. I mean, what would you say to other citizens who might be concerned about this? I mean, is there any kind of legal precedent that you're aware of where U.S. citizens would be protected from this?
China ultimately is a communist state. They play hardball. They try to extract as many concessions as they can in every single instance. It doesn't make any difference what the subject is. That's just how they play the game. So from my perspective, they just should know that we're organizing to guarantee that they feel a pushback. And we're working with Senator Cardin from Maryland on the whole exit issue. It's a concern, and we need to address it. But we're going to use this individual case as a way to get an insight into the way in which the Chinese operate.
Legal marijuana shops, too, opened in Massachusetts last week. There's legislation pending in Congress regarding marijuana, descheduling it from the list of federal drugs that are illegal, also possibly expunging federal marijuana convictions. Where do you stand on that?
On which bill is it?
On how about Cory Booker's legislation that would legalize marijuana and expunge federal marijuana convictions?
I would have to look at the specific details of Senator Booker's bill. From my perspective, I'm very interested in learning from the implementation of our own state law. To garner from our own experience what is unfolding, what the impacts are going to be, and then that will inform my judgment as to then what should be included in any national legislation as it moves forward.
But do you think that there needs to be change on the federal level regarding marijuana and the legalization of marijuana? Because now there are 10 states where it's legal on the state level but not on the federal level. Does something have
absolutely.
To give...
Absolutely. I agree with that. We can't have a federal policy which contradicts what is going on at the state level. The state of Massachusetts should have the right to determine what the relationship is between our 6.7 million people and marijuana. And we don't need the Trump Justice Department, the Trump White House trying to move in for political grandstanding purposes to try to upset consensus that has been created, not just in Massachusetts, but in Colorado and Washington State, which are serving as the laboratories in learning more about the issue. But we just can't have the Trump administration trying to upset the progress which we're making.
Lastly, I'd like to hear your thoughts about the future of the Democratic Party a bit. We will be hearing from Congressman Seth Moulton in just a moment. But the Boston Globe is running a piece today suggesting that you might be vulnerable in the 2020 election. It says because you're a white male incumbent who's been in Congress for more than 40 years, this could make you vulnerable, particularly after the race where Congresswoman-elect Ayanna Pressley defeated longtime incumbent Mike Capuano. I mean, does it make you leery? Do you get a message from the Pressley victory there?
We haven't even finished this cycle yet. We still have a special election in Mississippi to determine how many senators that we're going to have seated in January. And the way in which I always view the election cycle is I just do my best. I work hard. I fight for the things that the people of Massachusetts send me to Washington to do. I did that up in Lawrence. yesterday by bringing a Senate committee two warrants so that their concerns would be heard. That's a rare occurrence, but it's something that I thought was important. The same thing is true on climate change, on privacy, on immigration policy, on criminal justice reform. The issues which I work on are the issues which are of concern to the people in Massachusetts, and I do my best, you know, to be the leader on net neutrality, to be a leader in ensuring there's NIH funding for biomedical research, and at the end of the day, you know, I am I'm going to do my best to push back hard on the Trump administration with a Democratic House in the new Congress, and we're going to fight the Trump administration every step of the way to ensure that they don't implement policies which are harmful to the state of Massachusetts, but to the entire country.
So you're not necessarily taking any strong message from the Ayanna Pressley victory and thinking that there might be that you might be vulnerable because there might be a movement to getting more fresh faces in Congress.
I do my best to be at the cutting edge of every issue that affects the state of Massachusetts and our country. And on those issues, I fight and do my best to actually implement policies that are going to be effective. And that includes my success on the floor of the United States Senate on net neutrality this year, my work on climate change, my work on pipeline safety. It doesn't make any difference what the issue is. I just continue to fight. And my message is that Donald Trump cannot make America great again by making America hate again. And amongst other things, we have to fight to make sure that we have criminal justice reform, because we owe an apology to an entire generation of African-American young men that we incarcerated in the 1990s as part of the war on crack cocaine. And my job is to just keep fighting, energized every day, with the, you know, to respond to the attacks being launched by the Trump administration. And I have a reason to get up every day, which is what I do. I have never been more energized than I am right now to get up and fight, you know, for the things that Massachusetts stands for. And it is an honor to have the opportunity to do that.
All right, Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Staying with politics now, we turn from the Senate to the House, where Democrats picked up 39 seats in the midterm elections this month. That's more than enough for Democrats to retake the majority in the House, which means the party will be choosing the next speaker in January. Tomorrow, Democrats elect their nominee for speaker, and it's widely expected that Nancy Pelosi will be chosen, but not all Democrats are on board. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton is among a vocal group of Democrats pushing for new leadership. Moulton has taken some heat about this, including during a tense town hall meeting in Amesbury last week. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks caught up with Congressman Moulton yesterday, and Anthony is with us in studio. Welcome.
Hey, hi, Deb.
So, does Congressman Moulton have the votes to block Nancy Pelosi?
All right. Well, he says he does, and depending on how you look at the math, maybe he does. If 16 Democrats vote against Pelosi, she would be blocked when the full House votes next January. We know that Moulton is among a group of 15 Democrats, plus there are four newly elected members of Congress, all of whom say they oppose Pelosi. They have said that. But, Deb, the math changes daily because Pelosi is working hard to round up support. I mean, for example, she convinced one of the Democrats who signed that letter with Moulton last week saying they'd vote against her to support her. And she convinced Marcia Fudge, the Ohio congresswoman who Moulton hoped would challenge Pelosi and run for speaker, to support her as well. And right now, and this is the point, right now there's nobody who has said they want to run against her. So most observers expect her to have the votes to become speaker next January. Among other things, she's very good at vote counting and getting lining up support for issues and people that she cares about. So the money is on her being speaker again.
Now, you asked Congressman Moulton about his stand against Pelosi. What did he tell you?
Well, he's been saying for some time that the Democrats need new leadership. But it's interesting because now he's shifted his focus away from Pelosi exclusively and is talking about the entire three-person leadership team, calling for a conversation or a negotiation with Pelosi about promoting younger members of the caucus into the leadership. So to many, that sounds like a softening of his position, saying, hey, let's negotiate. So as you said, I spoke to Congressman Moulton yesterday about all of this, and let's listen to a bit of what he said.
No, I think it's time for a new generation of leadership in the House. I think that we ought to answer the call that the American people sent in the election 2 weeks ago for new ideas, new leadership, and a new way forward. If we simply respond by reinstalling the same three top leaders, it's not just Pelosi here, it's three top leaders in the House of Representatives who have been stagnant in the same position for more than a decade. That's not the right message for a country that needs to move forward, for a party that needs to respond to a totally different world. It's not the same world as we had in 2006.
So one of the things that I'm intrigued about is one of the things you said at your town hall meeting, and I think you just sort of said it right then, was that the American people basically voted for change. But didn't they get change in that they flipped the House from Republican leadership to Democratic leadership? I mean, isn't that the change they voted for?
I think they voted for a lot more than that. I don't think that just simply flipping the majority is enough. I think that we need to be fundamentally a government that's willing to take on the new challenges of the day. We're the party of the future. Democrats are the party of the future. We should be legislating on things like privacy and social media. Right now, the Europeans are setting the rules of the game. We should be talking about how to regulate drones. You know, I had a drone fly over my house two afternoons ago. Who's talking about what the privacy concerns are there? We need to deal with the automated workforce and the fact that our education isn't set up to respond to the demands of the new automated workforce, that so many Americans are finding themselves automated out of their jobs. And we need people who understand the tragedies of today, like gun violence, the gun violence problem, to really take those issues on for the American people. We had at the town hall in Amesbury, this amazing 17-year-old.
I heard her. She was something.
She was incredible. And really, frankly, ignored by the press. But it was, I think, one of the most powerful speakers at that town hall. And she said, nobody in Washington understands what it's like to go to school every single day and fear for your life. Because frankly, people just haven't grown up in that generation.
Well, let me stick with that gun control thing and a new generation of leadership, because this is an interesting subject to me. And I agree, she deserved more attention from the press and myself included. However, we had a new generation of leadership in the White House. Barack Obama, Sandy Hook happened. He cried on national TV. He couldn't get anything done on gun control. So I guess I'm asking you, is a new generation of leadership really going to be able to move that particular ball down the field?
Well, frankly, not if we just have the same leadership in the House. And that's the whole point here, yeah. Is that, as you just said, the president called for change. Congress didn't deliver. And I just don't have confidence that we're going to deliver for the American people if we do not get leadership that's more reflective of the American people today.
Mm. So who's your candidate? Who is this person if not Nancy Pelosi?
Well, look, this is the question that everybody's asking. And I'll be honest, of course, we would rather have a candidate who's come forward at this point. But what we've heard from all the people who are considering a challenge, who may or may not be, you know, organizing behind the scenes right now, is that they don't want to come forward until it's clear that she does not have the votes on the floor of the House. So look, count me among the people who wish strongly that someone would step up by now. I agree that that would be helpful to our effort, without a doubt. But unfortunately, the political reality of the stranglehold that our current leadership team has in the House is that no one wants to step up before it's clear that they're going to step down.
Well, you're one of the leaders of this push. Why not you? Why not put yourself for it?
Pelosi has tried to dub me one of the leaders of this. This is a broad-based sentiment in the caucus. But I've made it clear from the very beginning that I'm not going to run.
This idea of, you know, hashtag five guys going after Nancy Pelosi, that sort of stuff, I understand that it's not just white guys. But isn't there an appearance issue? I mean, Nancy Pelosi is, you know, the highest ranking Democratic woman in American history. And sort of focusing on her sends a signal that you heard about from your constituents at the town hall meeting last week. People are upset about it. What do you say to them? Because it is a powerful symbol.
Let's just understand what's going on here. We've called for change for the top three.
Yeah.
From the very beginning. And this has been a position I've had for 2 years. So this has never been a focus on Leader Pelosi. Now, it is true that the freshmen who won the majority for us, many of them made a promise specifically not to support her as a condition in their campaigns. And so we tailored our letter to fit that promise that the freshmen made. But let's be clear, from the very beginning and all the way through, this has been a call for generational change in all the top positions in our leadership.
One more question about Pelosi. Respond to the idea that of all times, this is sort of incredibly important to have a woman like Pelosi in there, a sort of master vote counter, someone who understands parliamentary procedure better than anybody because she has the experience. What's the argument against that right now?
We now have 234 Democrats in the House. The idea that there's only a couple people who can do this job and do it well and really bring our country forward, that people will look at and say, there's a speaker that represents the future of our party and the future of the country. That's what we're looking for. And the idea that there's only a couple people who can do that, I think, is frankly absurd.
There was a piece in the Washington Post just a few hours ago that suggested that you might be interested in negotiating directly with Nancy Pelosi, supporting her if she would be open to change within the rest of the leadership. Any truth to that?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the Washington Post suggested. But look, we're Democrats who are willing to talk about solutions for transition here. I mean, I think that's a reasonable position to take. But there's no question that we want to see change. And that's what the American people demand. That's what the freshmen who won the majority have demanded as a condition of getting elected. And that's what we're supporting.
That's Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, who represents the 6th District. He was speaking with WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks yesterday about his push for change and Democratic leadership. And Anthony's with us in studio. Anthony, do you think Moulton risks any political damage here?
I mean, it's possible. Time will tell. I mean, maybe he loses support, particularly among women, many of whom were angry about his focus on Pelosi. On the other hand, Moulton ran against an incumbent 4 years ago and won. A lot of people probably agree with his message that new blood in the party is a good thing. But, you know, this is one of those things that time's going to tell.
All right. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Deb.
And to read more of Anthony's story about Congressman Moulton, go to our website, WBUR.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, it's been a week since recreational marijuana sales began in Massachusetts, and there are still lots of details to work out. One of the two dispensaries that opened is in the small town of Leicester, but the store is so popular that town officials held a meeting with the dispensary owners today to try to figure out what to do about all the traffic. Another issue, banking. With cannabis still illegal under federal law, most banks will not work with marijuana companies. So in other states with legalized pot, such as California, for example, this means a mostly cash economy. And that creates all kinds of other issues. Joining us to talk about this from San Francisco via Skype is David Downs. He's the California editor for Leafly.com News. He's also the former cannabis editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Hi there, David.
Good afternoon, Deborah.
Also with us is Jim Smith. He's an attorney at Smith, Costello & Crawford, which represents about 24 cannabis businesses in Massachusetts. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon.
So, David, I want to start with you. California started selling recreational marijuana before Massachusetts, obviously. Can you describe very briefly the market now, and are companies mostly dealing in cash because of this banking issue?
That's right. The business experience in California is that these banking issues are a major headwind. There's, you know, talks about armored cars. There's taxes you have to pay quarterly in cash. And there's issues around access to your payroll as well as emergency loans. We're in the middle of a very big shakeout with legalization in California. And the majority of legacy operators are going to go out of business because they lack access to capital at an institutional level as much as the retail level hurts consumers in terms of merchant services access and ATMs and that kind of thing.
So who's lending to these California businesses right now? Anybody?
There's a wide spectrum of lenders, and they tend to be tolerant of a lot of risk. So you can't walk into necessarily Chase or Wells Fargo and get a small business loan. You're dealing with private equity people like MedMen or others in the space. You know, are also seeing people raise money on the stock market. Canada has turned into a cash spigot for cannabis investing.
I'm wondering, so Jim, your company, as we said, represents people here in Massachusetts who are in the marijuana industry. How are they dealing with financing and banking?
Oh, in a very similar way. There really is a capital crunch. There's very little capital. There's really three sources, and there's only three sources. Either you're very, very wealthy independently. That's the best source, of course, but also the rarest. Or you're going to turn to family and friends, which I would never recommend anybody do, but it is done quite frequently. And then, of course, as David points out, investors. And investors anticipate some rather aggressive returns. And frankly, they haven't come yet. You know, we're just starting here, and we've had medical only until just last week. Mm. And so we're seeing some of the investors putting some real pressure on some of the companies.
You know, David, you mentioned possible armored cars and securities. Is security a big issue? Have you had several instances in California where security's been a problem because of cash-only businesses?
Where we've seen unlicensed, unregulated retail commerce, there has been increasing risk of retail robberies, specifically in Los Angeles over the last generation of medical marijuana law. With legalization has come hundreds of pages of rules around cameras and security guards, and those issues have gone down considerably. Now you're hearing operators say, I don't want to send my guy down to the Board of Equalization with $20,000 in cash for taxes every week. There's a lot of headaches around that kind of thing. We are still seeing incidents of, potential robbery targets. And it's similar to a liquor store or any other place with a lot of cash that's not secured. The whole point of legalization was to move up the level of security.
Right. I want to go back to this financing issue and what we at least have heard about in Massachusetts so far. And I want to ask both of you about it. I know in Boston, GFA Federal Credit Union, it's actually headquartered in Gardner, but it's the only company that has publicly said that it would deal with recreational marijuana companies. Century Bank, which handles banking for some of the medical marijuana companies, hasn't said what it might do on the recreational side of things. But the Boston Business Journal is reporting that Century charges about $5,000 a month for checking services for medical marijuana clients. So, David, are you hearing that in California, that if there are lending institutions that will deal with marijuana companies, the fees can be pretty high?
Very much so. Banks, the ones that are willing to work with the industry, have the industry over a barrel. Cannabis remains federally illegal. It's a Schedule I drug. It's akin to taking heroin dollars. And the regulators at FinCEN are not giving a green light to this. They're giving a flashing red light. Bankers say we're doing 1,000 times the amount of paperwork for our cannabis clients. But where there are fees, there are bankers. And so there's several hundred banks in America, specifically credit unions, leading the way. That are baking cannabis clients, and you're hearing stuff about $25,000 retainers just to open an account, or a 12% tax on all deposits on an annual level. And again, this is an equity killer. This shakes out the more than 50% of the mom and pops that created this industry much more than any other force.
Huh. And go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
In Massachusetts, it isn't quite that aggressive. I mean, Century, you're absolutely right. Century is in excess of $5,000 for an account. Now, you refer to it as a lending institution. We should not mislead anybody. They will not lend. There is absolutely zero credit from any bank, credit unions included, in this country. But they do handle payroll, and they do handle the cash. And we're also seeing, I'm sure David is as well, in California, a lot of debit card transactions. Those work. Credit cards do not. Mm. And believe me, I'm not a banking expert. I can't imagine what the FDIC is thinking, but they do differentiate. So you do see, you walk into any one of these shops as well, you see an ATM machine. A lot of $20 bills changing hands in Massachusetts. The issues, though, are very, very similar to California. Although I will say, we had a much smaller unregulated industry than what was available was in California. Not that we didn't have an illicit industry. We do, but not quite the magnitude of California. And so I think it's going to be a little easier for us to ultimately get our arms around the illicit portion of this industry and really try to bring it into the normal, banking discourse and business discourse where, transactions become far more common and regulated. It'll take some time. I think our problems are probably less than the ones David is seeing in California.
Do you think?
That's right.
Go ahead,
Dave. Less clarity there is in a state's laws, the more problems there are with normalized access.
Absolutely.
So, for example, in Canada, you have major institutional banks who are already making loans because it's federally legal there. And that's really the drumbeat you're starting to hear in Washington is we want clarity.
Right. What about this notion of a public bank, which I'm understanding is being discussed in California? David, is that something that might help here?
Los Angeles put a public bank idea to its voters, and it failed in the 2018 midterms. It comes from Europe and I believe North Dakota, where there's been some industry interest banks that will loan to just the farmers. The people looking at this saying this costs a lot of money. We don't know how much it's going to cost. And we don't know if we're going to be staring federal regulators in the face when we do so. The FinCEN cares a lot about money laundering, and they take a really hard, long look at cannabis transactions.
Jim,
the idea was floated here in Massachusetts as well. I mean, we have so much in common with California. The idea was floated by the Cannabis Control Commission, just very briefly. It was just sort of a trial balloon. It was rapidly shut down by the governor and many others. So we're not going to see a cannabis-specific bank here.
Do you think, though, Jim, that the Cannabis Control Commission in Massachusetts should be stepping in here and should be trying to do something to help?
I think they are. I think that they're raising the obvious issues here. I mean, cash is dangerous. Nothing good comes of cash. Money laundering, potential robberies, although, as I said, we've had none in our state, fortunately. Nobody wants the people to walk around with tens of thousands of dollars in their back pocket. And so that issue has been raised. The Cannabis Control Commission, though, has really no jurisdiction over banking at all in Massachusetts.
Right.
And other than being an advocate for some kind of assistance, that's about all they can do, and they've done that.
Okay. Jim Smith, an attorney with Smith, Costello & Crawford, represents about 24 cannabis businesses in Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Thank you, Deborah.
Also with us was David Downs. He's the California editor for Leafly.com News. He's also the former cannabis editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. He joined us via Skype. Thanks for being with us, David.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stay with us. Coming up, exploring the effects of sea level rise on America's coastlines. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A major federal report is warning that climate change could reduce the size of the U.S. economy by about 10% by the end of the century. The report, released last week, comes just a month after the United Nations predicted that the world could face a climate crisis by 2040. Environmental writer Elizabeth Rush says that might sound far from now, but many Americans are already living with some of the devastating effects of climate change. Rush spent 5 years exploring America's coastlines, which she details in her book titled Rising: Dispatches from the New American Shore. When we spoke, I asked her what first inspired her to investigate sea level rise as a book topic.
I was teaching at the College of Staten Island when Hurricane Sandy washed ashore in 2012, and Staten Island was profoundly impacted by this storm. Our college campus remained closed for a number of weeks, and when we reopened, many of my students were missing. They had been, displaced by the storm, and then were living in temporary FEMA housing or were living with friends and family, often in New Jersey. And most of the College of Staten Island students have part-time or full-time jobs on top of their studies. They had to make a series of really difficult decisions after Sandy. Do I continue to pursue my degree? Their university studies really took a back burner to some other more pressing issues. And that's when I started to realize that in this really subtle way, climate change and sea level rise in particular was already starting to dismantle some of our most vulnerable communities in this country. So I started to become profoundly interested in this question: who's feeling the early impacts of sea level rise? How is it changing their communities? And where do you go with that knowledge?
I was going to ask you to read a little bit of your book, and it's actually from when you were writing about Staten Island, and you reflect a little bit on tidal marshes. I'm wondering if you could read that here.
Absolutely. For most of my life, I never gave tidal marshes much thought, but now they are, in their sly and unassuming way, absorbing my attention. To most, a wetland is just a mess of grass, the sulfuric scent of decomposition, miasmas, and mud. But I'm beginning to see them as divining rods, signaling where there will be more water in the future, and even more importantly, that the future is, in many cases, already here.
Hmm. That's beautiful. You write so beautifully about this, so it's so different from other types of environmental writing. But I'm wondering, in the time that you spent, particularly in Staten Island, and you say that you learned that in many cases the future is already here, describe what that was like.
When I started writing about sea level rise, many of the early reports would talk about climate change as this future problem. And I think that we still very much do that today. Even more recently, the IPCC said, you know, we need to start talking about 2040, that we need to start talking about what are the severe early impacts of climate change that will manifest by 2040. But the reality is we're already seeing sea level rise in our coastal community. So when you look at a tidal marsh, that is a very low-lying ecosystem. So one thing that I started to notice in many of these tidal marshes all around the country is you're starting to see these marshes drowned. And I started to get really interested both in tidal marshes and the more than human communities that inhabit them, but also the human communities that live alongside of or on top of tidal marshes.
Right. You visit Maine, Rhode Island, Louisiana, Florida, California. And because we're primarily based in New England, tell our listeners what messages you took from the coast of Rhode Island.
So within, you know, the first week when I lived in Rhode Island, I biked out to the nearest tidal marsh that I could find close to Providence. And there I found something that I had started to notice in tidal marshes all around the country, a series of big coastal hardwood trees that had died because of saline inundation. And I started to become really obsessed with these trees and obsessed with this form, because I think if you look at any tidal marsh, if you go to a tidal marsh that you know, or even that you pass by, you know, on your commute, or that some part, peripheral part of your life, I will bet you money that you will find dead hardwood trees in that tidal marsh. And they're dying because of saline inundation, and they're dying because of higher tides and stronger storms. When their root system suck up an excess of salt water, that leads to the stunting of growth and the eventual death of that tree. And I think for many, climate change remains difficult to touch. But if we go to these coastal communities, if we go to these tidal marshes, and we start to look and pay attention to the species that have long lived there, we'll notice these big trees. They're hard to overlook. And you see them, and for me, they're really a marker that the world has already changed, that climate change is with us in the present tense.
In Boston, our mayor, Marty Walsh, has outlined a climate change plan, and it involves creating this system of waterfront parks, trying to restore marshes, and elevating infrastructure, basically. It's a very complicated plan, but I would say that those are probably the three main elements of it. Would you say that that is essentially what many cities should be thinking about right now?
Well, one of the places that I spent a lot of time was San Francisco, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they have the second largest wetlands rehabilitation project in the entire country. And they're restoring wetlands all around the coast in the San Francisco Bay Area. And a lot of those wetlands they're trying to restore at a slow grade, which means that they're trying to give those wetlands a chance to migrate up and in as well as sea levels rise. But the folks out in San Francisco will tell you, you know, these wetlands, even as we build them on these slow slopes so they can migrate up and in, all they're doing is buying us time. They're buying us time to understand the fact that we are going to have to move a lot of people. We're going to have to move a lot of low-lying infrastructure. And if we can, you know, create sort of a stopgap valve to give us 20, 30, 40 years to wrap our minds around that fact, then let's do that. And let's do that in a way that can create ecosystems for threatened and endangered species as well.
Right. You write about this sort of retreat from some coastal communities like Staten Island. So basically, retreat is unavoidable, in your opinion.
Yes. I mean, I think retreat is unavoidable. I was just reading one of the latest publications in Nature, which is a leading, you know, scientific mm-hmm. journal. And they're finding that Antarctica is melting at rates 30 times faster than the low ball predictions that the International Panel on Climate Change predicts. So going back to those questions about Boston and its infrastructure, yes, we need to think about innovative infrastructure solutions, but ultimately they're going to buy us time. And the lowest lying places, the places that, you know, have long flooded, tidal marshes are flood prone landscapes to begin with. Those are places that I think we are going to have to consider giving up. Mm. And some of Boston is built on fill and some of Boston is built on tidal marsh.
Right. You talk about specific areas, Newbury Street, right? I mean, you know, different places like that, like what will happen? It will be dramatically changed because of climate change. But of course, the big question is when. And you mentioned the United Nations climate change report and 2040, which was the date in that report as to when some immediate effects of climate change might be noticeable. Is that what you take away? Do you take away that date unless dramatic steps are taken to change things?
This morning, I thought to myself, oh, that's 20 years. That hadn't really hit me. I think it still can feel sort of strange, abstract, a projection. Mm-hmm. Using that date, I think, produces a feeling of magical thinking that we're not actually in the middle of climate change now. You know, if you are a low-income person living atop a tidal marsh, climate change is already real for you in the present tense.
Right. You know, I just want to ask something a little bit related to the UN report, because there was a study that came out shortly after that report about how climate change will affect the price of beer, right? It could triple in some countries. And the study's authors say, you know, that's not the biggest deal about climate change, but it might make people more concerned about climate change. I mean, because they are these projections of 20 years away, maybe at the most alarming, if you will, you know, what do you do to get people concerned about this as a problem? What do you do to get attention to this?
That question was very much in my mind while I was writing Rising. I felt like the climate change reporting that I was seeing was sort of the repetition of a series of statistical anomalies, you know, record-breaking heat waves, record-breaking storms, record-breaking rain, every year smashing the previous year's record-breaking record. And I think that kind of writing can inadvertently sort of numb us to what a profound transformation we are living through. And so as I wrote Rising, the thing that most changed me was sitting in a stranger's living room and listening to them describe the moment, you know, the water works up the driveway and under the door, the sinking knowledge that they're going to have to, you know, redo all of the flooring in their home. And many people experience one flood and then they experience a second and a third. As I wrote Rising, I wanted to bring that lived experience into this discussion. I wanted to move away from the scientific discourse. I wanted to put the lived experience front and center with the hope of sort of touching people's hearts around this issue, not just their intellect.
Hmm. In the New York Times review of your book, it said, this is a book for those who mourn the changing climate. I mean, what do you make of characterizing your work as sort of an elegy?
I think it's one part elegy, but I also think that my work is one part radical resilience. It's true that I mourn the loss of species, the loss of language to talk about some of the plants and animals that have long resided along the water's edge. But I also found great hope, especially in a place like Oakwood Beach, Staten Island, where you had 9 different low-lying, lower-income, largely right-leaning communities say after Sandy, we don't feel safe living here anymore, and we want this land to return to nature so it can act as a buffer in the storms to come. These are people who I would not have thought of as being some of the most progressive climate activists in this country, and here they were. They were willing to move away from their houses so that their sacrifice might benefit those around them and those in surrounding communities, and that the land would sort of be held as a commons for all. I find that really deeply hopeful.
Elizabeth Rush, she teaches creative nonfiction at Brown University. She's also taught at Southern New Hampshire University, and she's currently the 2019 Antarctic Artist and Writer in Residence for the National Science Foundation. Her book is titled Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore. Elizabeth, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.